Now entering Nerdist.com.
I am absolutely fascinated by my No-No Pro. The No-No Pro is a remarkable way to remove unwanted hair with no pain. Whether it's your legs, arms, face, back, knuckles, belly button area, whatnots, it's easy to use and the weeks of long-lasting results are quite cost-effective. Buying the No-No Pro at nonosandra.com comes with a 100% 60-day money-back guarantee. Plus, when you purchase, you'll get a $50 gift card to an award-winning skincare line. So go to nonosandra.com, nonosandra.com, like you're mad at me a little bit. That's nonosandra.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra Podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Hey, naughty monkeys. Welcome to episode number 150. I don't know if you were counting, but I sure was. And this is, we did it. 150. I'm excited about today's show. The first, a few things, dates. There's a lot coming up. Check out sexnerdsandra.com on the right-hand side. There's all the upcoming events. Portland, Los Angeles, San Diego, DC, Austin, New York. I've got a lot of stuff coming up. So let's get into it. First, Portland. Hey, I am hosting a live podcast with the Oh Joy sex toy creator, Erica Moen, the evening of Thursday, July 17th. Now, Erica Moen is adorable and fierce, and I like her as a person, and I just feel like we'll have so much to talk about around this amazing webcomic she's created. If you haven't seen this yet, Google it right now. Oh Joy sex toy. You must check it out. If you know people in the Portland area, let them know, because she's not only doing a bunch of sex positive work, she's also a remarkable artist and an interesting human. She's an interesting American. And tickets are only $12. I'll be at Dante's in Portland, so you can check out dantesLive.com or just go to sexnerdsandra.com for the ticket link. Please, I would love to see you there. I'd love to show Erica how much we appreciate her work. And it's going to be awesome and hilarious. I have a few surprises in store and I don't want to tell her, so I can't tell you. Okay. I'll also be doing a Portland workshop, Boning 101, July 20th. That'll be at Shebop, a fantastic sex store I've heard a lot about. Check out the ticket link, sheboptheshop.com or sexnerdsandra.com. Los Angeles, I will be teaching the very first class at Los Angeles Academy of Sex Ed. Balls deep, the fundamentals of fellatio. That's right. That's right. You heard me correctly. That will be at 7 o'clock p.m. $25 online, $30 at the door. It is a small, intimate setting. It's exclusive. It's 18 and up. So brownpapertickets.com or just go to my site and get tickets soon, because it's already close to sold out. Okay. San Diego Comic-Con at the end of July. I will be at it and I will probably be doing some panels or some filming there. Stay tuned for details, but just put it on your calendar. Washington, D.C., how are you? I'm pretty excited to see you soon. I am going to Reed Mihalko's Sex Geek Summer Camp. I will be talking about my work and my career in sex ed. And we'll be talking about podcasting. And Sex Geek Summer Camp is basically a business conference set in a camping atmosphere. It is ridiculously affordable as business conferences go. And this is for anyone who listens to the show and is like, I want to do what Sandra does. I would like to do something similar. I would like to work in the health field. I would like to light people's minds on fire. Yes, do it. But a lot of people who want to do that need to know a lot about the business side of things. So that's what this is about. So you can check out Sex Geek Summer Camp. Go to my page. Use my link on my page because that would be helpful to me. I have an affiliate with it. I don't really affiliate. Like, I'm not an affiliate person, but I feel like I'd try it and I really believe in this for people who want to do this. So, hey, click on my link, right? That's what I'm supposed to do, right? Okay. I will also be going to the Woodhull Sexual Freedom Alliance in DC from August 14th through the 17th. Austin, I will be in you at the end of September from the 25th through the 29th. I'll be there for a wedding, but I'm going to see if I can teach a workshop or host a live show while I'm there. New York. Hey, how's it going? So New York Comic-Con is hosting something brand new this year called Super Week. and I am going to be part of it. So I'm teaching Boning 101 in partnership with them October 10th at Madam X. That'll be from 7 to 9, and it is a very sexy atmosphere there. So please come and join me. Okay, that's the dates. That's a lot of stuff. It's a lot of things. Hey, thanks for staying with me. I want to make sure that I let you know that I really appreciate anyone who makes iTunes comments and rates the show, because that helps keep us up in the higher areas of visibility, and it lets other people find the show. And I've created 150 episodes on topics of all sorts of interests, and there's still so many more episodes and topics to do. It's just exciting. So that's a thing. Hey, have you gotten a Sex Nerd Sandra t-shirt yet? Is that a thing that you would like to do? A tote bag? Maybe some stickers? Merchtable.com has all the Sex Nerd Sandra merch. Check it out. I forget to tell you sometimes, most of the time, so I just wanted to remind you. Okay, let's get to this week. So two big topics this week. I interviewed Adam Rogers, the author of a fantastic book, Proof, The Science of Booze. And he's delightful. He's just absolutely delightful. He's been on the Nerdist Writers Panel podcast. He's been on the Nerdist podcast. And I was able to snatch him to talk about sex-related science. So that was pretty cool. Surprising amount of butt stuff in alcohol science. Well, you'll just have to see for yourself. I did record in a very large hardwood floor, very beautiful room, but hardwood floors. Kids, if you ever have a podcast, do not record in a big, hard room. Just don't, because you know what happens? It sounds like you're echoing. And I, every once in a while, think it's going to be fine. No, sounds like an echo. But you know what? We're always improving, right? It's a journey. So before we get to the alcohol science and fun therein, we will be talking to attorney Alan Gelbard about the Supreme Court contraception and corporations. This week, there was a major decision thrown down around those issues. We're going to be talking about contraception that was allowed to be taken out of healthcare plans that corporations are paying for their employees. And the four contraceptions we're talking about are emergency contraception, Plan B, and Ella, and the IUD and two IUDs. IUDs are one of the most effective, if not the most effective, birth control methods available. And it's highly disappointing that that has been taken off. It's just not abortion, you guys, and you're not killing any. You know, I trust everyone has the ability to find accurate information. You can always call San Francisco Sex Information if you have any questions or concerns. But I'm really glad that I was able to get this short discussion for my clarification and yours. So enjoy this week's episode. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you, and go team fun. Hi, Alan Gelbard, Esquire.
Hi, Sex Nerd Sandra.
Hi, I have brought in a lawyer. You may remember him from, what was it, the condom? I don't remember what I called it, but the condoms.
We did one
in
on
porn.
Condoms, then we did another one on my other interest.
Do you want that? Is that allowed?
Of course it's allowed.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. Yes, you've been on a couple times. Mm-hmm. And this Monday, my Facebook feed was filled with the Supreme Court decision to rule with Hobby Lobby and some other wooden...
Conestoga Wood.
Yeah, Conestoga Wood, around them not having to pay for contraception or certain kinds of contraception in their employee health care package. And you know, lots of sex educators very angry in my Facebook feed. I don't know who you follow.
I follow a lot of the same people you do.
Oh yeah.
I share their outrage.
Yeah, you saw that. And I didn't know how I felt about it. I mean, immediately I felt uncomfortable and angry and frustrated. Like, come on, can we just calm down and whatnot? I guess, okay, what background do we need? The Supreme Court decided five to four in favor of the corporations to say that they can, totes have their religious right. beliefs can change their healthcare funding and for the whatever. I care, but I don't care. I care. I get not trying to make someone pay for something that they think is going to go against their religious beliefs, and the contraception that keeps a fertilized egg from implanting in the uterine wall in their idea of life starting at contraception.
Conception. That's right, interesting Freudian slip. Happiness begins at contraception. Life, on the other hand.
Conception. It's like, I respect that. I absolutely respect that. But it feels like healthcare is a part of your benefits for working for someone, like the money. I don't believe that my employer should have any say in how I spend my money that I earn from them for doing their job. And I think of healthcare as an extension of that. Mm-hmm. And so why are they deciding which things are going to be covered when generally the medical community is like, you guys, this is pretty important. That's how I feel. And so it frustrates me. And it puts a burden, I imagine, on the government to cover the things that they're not covering.
It well may. You need to take a sort of a big picture and then sort of start with a big picture and then work your way down.
Okay.
The big picture is the Constitution sets out free exercise and establishment clauses to control religion in this country.
Okay.
In order to promote religious diversity, the free exercise clause prevents governments from preventing people exercising their own religion. Now, I think you probably will find that Justice Ginsburg's dissent in the case, if you read it, is right along the lines of what you're talking about. Initially, the First Amendment, the free exercise clause, was found back in a case called Smith, which, interestingly enough, Justice Scalia wrote.
Okay.
Because in that case, the religion that was involved was an Indian religion. A couple of American Indians were fired from their job for taking peyote as part of their religious sacrament.
Huh.
And the old law was that you had this sort of compelling interest test. And the Supreme Court said, no. When there's a general law, a law of general applicability that doesn't target religion, that isn't aimed at affecting religion, mm-hmm. whether you're religious or not, you got to follow the regular rules. So if your religion says, look, I don't want to stop at red lights, too darn bad, you got to stop at the red light. Okay.
Okay. I was wondering
about
that.
So Justice Scalia writes this opinion. And then there's this huge outcry from people going, no, you're trampling on our rights. So Congress, almost unanimously, I think it was 97-3 or something like that, passes the Religious Freedom Restoration Act,
ooh,
which I personally think was unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause, but I don't wear a black robe.
The Establishment Clause, which is the thing
government
that's...
can't do things in favor of religion.
I see.
There are arguments that say that the super conservative says all that means is you can't establish a national religion. That issue has been completely discredited, or that point of view has been discredited. Basically, what it means is you can't do things that favor religion over mm-hmm. non-religion, or one religion over another religion.
Mm-hmm.
So I happen to think that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act helps establish religion. It favors religion over non-religion, and so it should be unconstitutional. But
it seems like there are a lot of laws and cases that are favoring religion, and religion really
are.
There's a certain amount of privilege that I hear from religious groups saying that they expect to be treated specially.
There are a couple of tests that the Supreme Court has announced about how you decide whether something violates the Establishment Clause, and this could turn into a long-winded constitutional law class, so we're not going to do that.
Okay.
But suffice it to say that a couple of courts of appeal have ruled that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is not unconstitutional. I disagree, but be that as it may, it reestablished the Smith test, it overruled Smith. It reestablished the tests before Smith, which were if a law of general applicability substantially burdens religion, mm-hmm. then there has to be a compelling government interest for the law, and it has to be no greater than necessary to affect the interest. And so that's what we're dealing with now.
So in layperson's term, if there's a law like red lights and it's mm-hmm. burdening all the people who don't believe in lights or something, mm-hmm. then the government has to really be like, no, y'alls, this is for safety's sake.
Yeah, there's a compelling interest, which is we don't want anybody getting killed.
Okay.
And it's no greater than necessary, because if we allow some people to run the light, then you'll never know whether it's safe to stop or not. So that's a really good analogy. But what the plaintiffs in Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Woods said is, look, we feel – our religious belief is that abortion is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they're entitled to that belief. The mm-hmm. question is whether they're allowed to enforce that religion on other people.
Okay.
And that's really what's happening here. They're saying that they should not have to provide contraception for their employees because they feel it violates their religious freedom. I think there's a problem with that goes to Justice Ginsburg's dissent as well.
So the idea that it impinges, it hinders, it disenfranchises religious people when they have to pay for something that goes against their beliefs.
Right. Well, see, that's one of the things that Justice Ginsburg says in her dissent is it has to substantially affect a person's practice of their religion. Now, first off, the question is, can a corporation practice religion at all?
Mm-hmm.
And Justice Alito's opinion goes on to say that because these are closely held corporations, and mm-hmm. that's a strong deterrent here, qualifier, closely held corporations. These families own all the shares. They run the companies.
Mm-hmm.
These companies are really just extensions of these families. He gives them a pass on that one. I think that's wrong. And I think that opens what we lawyers call a slippery slope, which is now every corporation out there is going to say, but we have really closely held religious beliefs too.
Right.
How does a corporation practice religion? Okay. It has no closely mm-hmm. held beliefs. The corporation has no beliefs at all. Only the people that own the corporations have beliefs, the shareholders and the people that run it.
And in terms of taxes
mm-hmm.
and things like that, we treat the corporation like one reason why people create corporations to protect themselves, right? Like the
right.
corporation is separate from themselves.
Correct. You get a benefit for using the corporate form.
Exactly.
So you don't have personal liability.
And then they go around and make a corporation owned by
those corporations are people too, according to this current Supreme Court.
Oh, snap.
And so you get all the benefits, but you don't have any of the burdens. And this, you know, this case is not just a First Amendment case. There is a lot of business friendliness that this particular court has. And I got to say, not to pat myself on the back, but I was talking about this in the companion case that came down yesterday, the union case with another lawyer in our office here last week. And I said, here's what's going to happen. Next Monday, they're going to release it. We're going to lose them both. Alito's going to write them both, and it's going to be 5-4. And he's like, oh, that's crazy. And that's exactly what happened. And these cases are not just about religion. They're about being business friendly. This court never met a business concern that it didn't like. And oh, by the way, the five members on the court that voted for this are not just Republican appointees. They're all Catholics.
Hmm.
So that also tends to affect
right.
the religious element of this thing.
Because as a reminder of Government 101, the Supreme Court, it's a lifetime appointment. And so
life or good behavior.
Right. Right. So beyond being business friendly, it's also incredibly sexual health unfriendly. It's prioritizing corporation over fundamental preventative health
yes.
issues, which are important, for women, half of the population, but also anybody who's partnered with a woman working for these companies. Everyone suffers.
Well, what the court really did here, and I think it's completely disingenuous, is it said, look, the government makes restrictions for real religious corporations. I mean, companies that run churches or companies that run religious bookstores. There is a mechanism in place where the government allows these companies to buy healthcare. Contraceptive portion of that healthcare is provided by the government instead.
Mm-hmm.
And so the court says, because that's available, this isn't the least restrictive mechanism.
Okay. I was reading that and I had no idea what it meant. So that makes more sense.
But the problem with all of this is it glosses over the first question, which is a corporation can't practice religion.
Mm-hmm.
A corporation has no soul, at least none that I know of.
Mm-hmm.
Corporations are there to make money. And these corporations are clearly there to make money. That is all they do. And so if you are going to elect the protection of the corporate form, you give up the right to make these kinds of personal decisions. Now,
especially for your employees.
Yeah, that's really the thing. And Justice Ginsburg talks about this. In all the other cases where we balance religious freedom, one of the things that you're looking at is what effect does this religious freedom have on third parties?
Mm-hmm.
And so in this case, it really does. The people that work for these companies are now at least temporarily deprived of that right. If your doctor says that one of those contraceptive devices is the appropriate one for you, your employer now gets to say no. Now, here's the other interesting thing about this. The right is so attenuated that it doesn't really fit into a religious practice at all. The company isn't buying you an abortion. The company is buying healthcare,
uh-huh.
which provides if the doctor and the woman decide they want to use it, those particular drugs.
It's so absolutely far removed.
It's so far removed. And that's really where the court has gone to really great lengths to figure out a way to shoehorn this thing in. It's a really disingenuous opinion, and it really is overly protective of religious freedom.
Yeah. And on the sexuality front, I mean, I'm frustrated because women spend so much time fertile. And to actually plan when you're going to have kids. Like, mm-hmm. let's say someone gets married at 20, and let's say they go through menopause at 50. That's 30 years. And then you've got, let's say you want to have two kids within a five-year period, right, in your early 30s, and you're married with a man.
You've got 25 years.
Does that mean that everyone just expects them to just not have sex until it's time for...
Well, you got to remember something. There are a few people in that extremely Catholic religion out there that do. They think that, you know, sex is just for making babies, and that anything with it, you know, if you have sex with your husband and you get pregnant, that is a gift from God, and it's not for us lay people to know what God wants. I happen to think that's a crock of shit.
I mean, the sacrament of marriage is about, I mean, there's so much connection between spouses, like just the idea of sort of stripping away all of that beautiful, like, companionship and connection that two people have, dumb it down to, you know, babies. That's it.
Yeah. Look, we as a society are loath to come right out and say, look, sex is fun and can be fun and should be fun. And yeah, it's great for making babies and there's an intimate connection. But what's wrong with having a little responsible fun? Mm-hmm. And so what these laws do is they prevent, to one degree or another, that kind of responsible fun, which violates the religious tenets of these hardcore religious fanatics.
Yeah.
And so the court is going the wrong way on this. Now, it's funny because eventually what will happen is you'll see, you know, society will swing, and then the people that take their sexual freedom for granted today, who don't think, oh, you know, my right to an abortion is safe and my right to contraception is safe, all of a sudden it's going to be gone. Mm-hmm. You know, the coat hanger days are going to be back, and then there's going to be this huge backlash. So the court's treading somewhat cautiously, but I think it's making a big mistake here.
Yeah, it's scary. It's a little scary. Also, did you read about this was kind of a big thing, about how their 401k invests in companies who make abortion-inducing drugs and contraception?
I didn't see that, but I'm not surprised. I mean, the hypocrisy that goes around in our modern world, some of it knowing, some of it unknowing, is just breathtaking.
Yeah, it's can I fill you in? Can I give you the gossip?
I can kind of figure it out from what you told me.
It was neat because, what was it, Forbes? No, Mother Jones. Mm-hmm. That was the article that was going around, like, hypocrisy alert. So then I went over to Forbes, and this opinion piece was like, you guys are idiots. Like, Mother Jones, like a totally stupid face, because mutual funds, you don't get to choose all the tiny little things because, you know, that's like a totally other thing. As if healthcare.
I was just going to say.
But then I scrolled down. I saw the other opinion of the more left-wing guy going, there are mutual fund options where they take out those questionable options.
Sure.
And they perform well. And yet Hobby Lobby didn't even take the time to, like, do all that?
The reality is they may not have even known. And the reality is that's not as big a concern for me. Who they invest in, this part of the hypocrisy thing doesn't bother me as much as the idea that somebody that's running a company thinks that he has a right to interject himself between his female employees and their doctor. Mm-hmm. That's the really scary part here. Mm-hmm. I mean, could you imagine the outcry there would be if a particular company decided that they weren't going to fund Viagra? You know, all these healthcare
Viagra and Cialis vasectomies.
And all of this, and vasectomies and all of these things. That's all okay, you know, but it's somehow women in these groups are thought of as second-class citizens that need protection from themselves somehow. And that's really reprehensible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting.
Go women.
Yeah, go women. Go, yeah, uteruses and stuff.
I like women parts.
Women parts are great. Yeah, they're real handy. You know, you can hide stuff in there. You know? Also, more gossip, even though you clearly are unfazed by the 401k thing. Also, they do not cover maternity leave.
Now, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you can have maternity leave unpaid and use your vacation time and your accrued whatever time, but you don't get any maternity leave if you have a baby.
That's ridiculous. In fact, this is not my area of expertise, but I believe even California has some statutes, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's some federal statutes about that. that protect workers under circumstances like that.
Well, I read an article on the internet.
The internet. Yes, it is your friend.
You
know, I think the real important thing to be gleaned from all of this is that voting is important and elections have consequences. There are a number of people up in Oregon who thought it was a good idea to bust Al Gore's chops and vote for Ralph Nader.
Uh-huh.
And because of that and some other stupid things, we got George W. Bush, who put two of the current Supreme Court justices on the bench.
Mm-hmm.
Roberts, who's going to be there forever, and Alito. I'm sorry, Roberts is the Chief Justice.
Okay.
And Alito, who is now going to be there for a very long time, who wrote both of these terrible opinions last couple of days. Had Gore won, neither of those gentlemen would have been on the court. And had these issues gone up, I'm sure they would have come out a different way. And so when people think, well, you know, voting for a Democrat or a Republican is the same thing, they really need to think about that.
Mm-hmm.
The most important job a president has is putting a guy on the Supreme Court, or a woman, a jurist on the Supreme Court. My apologies.
I call everyone guy.
So, you know, the Senate has to advise and consent and approve them, but the president gets to appoint Supreme Court justices, and that makes more difference in our lives than most of the other things that we think about on a day-to-day basis.
It's so true. That's an extraordinary point, and one that I need to start voting more for sure. I tend to get a little lazy, but let's see.
You know, it's easy to get disaffected, and it's easy to think, well, it's just one vote, and it's easy to think, well, mine, you know, yeah, it counts, but like I'm in a blue state, so if there's one more vote, it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But that breeds this sort of apathy, and it needs to end.
Yeah.
The reason money is so powerful in politics is because it convinces the stupid people to vote against their best interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so especially the smart people, you know, the people that listen to your broadcast all the time, have to get out there and vote.
I want more people to be going into law because I feel like policy is so important. Like we need more sex positive people to be getting degrees in things like accounting, you know.
Yeah.
And I always say accounting. I don't know why I'm like fixed on that. But sex positive teachers, just I want people who are lit on fire by what we're talking about to go into all the fields, spread the good word, and infiltrate, you guys, infiltrate.
Yeah, it's been an interesting thing as a, you know, sort of an out sex positive lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been featured on magazines and got a fair amount of press and stuff. And occasionally I'll walk into a court and somebody will look at me and there's that sort of smirk or there's that sort of titillation thing. I take that sort of as a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in what I do. I think that, you know, sex is an important part of life and sexual entertainment, although it pisses a lot of people off, is an important thing. A lot of people get great joy from it. And if, you know, as George Carlin said, you know, the radio has two knobs. If you don't like what's on, you know, one turns it on and off and the other one changes the channel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, protecting the First Amendment and protecting the rights that we as sex positive people hold dear is an important job. And it's like someone's got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if there were more people doing it with me.
Yeah.
And critical reasoning
is
something that everybody needs to study. And that, unfortunately, is the big problem with religion is that, at least in my humble opinion, teaching belief mechanisms underlies or undermines the ability to engage in critical reasoning. So if you believe something to the exclusion of that which you actually physically observe, and you can do that, it is much easier to manipulate you as a human being. And so belief systems are problematic. Critical reasoning is a good thing.
See, but religion seems extremely problematic because it's fixed. But belief is exciting. I don't know. There's something exciting about mystery, but then the curiosity and being willing to change and evolve with that mystery.
That's,
you know,
really important. Being able to change, being willing to change is the most important part. There was a great debate on creationism on the internet, which I actually like watched for the whole 2 hours and whatever between Bill Nye and I can't remember the guy's name, with a church that has dinosaurs being ridden by people.
Oh, yeah. I was glued to my laptop for that one.
I was screaming at the computer screen because every time Bill Nye would speak, I'm like, yeah, right. And every time the other guy would speak, I'm like, are you nuts? But one of the things that one of the people in the audience asked was, look, I understand that you're committed to your ideal. Is there anything that would change your mind? And Bill Nye, the science guy, said, listen, if somebody brought me empirical evidence that I'm wrong, that there is a God, I would examine the evidence. And if it held sway with me, I would believe it. Mm-hmm. And the other guy was like, nope, the Bible's literal word of God. And there's nothing that anybody could give me that would show that that was wrong.
Yeah, that's a really that's a big red flag right there.
Yeah, if you are so intransigent in your position, then you might want to reevaluate your intransigence before you even get to your position.
Ah, big words, big ideas.
Big words.
Thank you so much for joining me and talking with me about this.
It's always a pleasure to join you.
Yeah. How can people find you in the world, or is it secrets?
It's not hard. I'm xxxesq.com. I'm easy to find.
Awesome. All right. Naughty Monkeys coming up next. Alcohol, the science, oh, and juicy tidbits about the mating dance. Hey, sex monkeys. I'm here with an amazing human being, fascinating, intelligent creature named Adam Rogers. Hi.
Hello there.
Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I feel pretty good about being amazing. That's a nice intro. I'll take it.
I have enjoyed being in groups of people with you recently. You know, mutual friends, hanging out, delightful conversationalist. And then you decide to get even more awesome with publishing a book called Proof, The Science of Booze.
I did do that. It took me a long time.
Did
but
it?
I did finally publish it. Yes.
How long did it take you?
It's about 3 years from start to finish.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, long road.
I've been trying to write my first sex book since like age 9, so.
Not that long ago.
I'm so tired. This is very exciting that I have you for asking the information. Okay, so you just wrote this book. I learned about you being so into booze.
That makes it sound like a problem. I don't know when you put it that way.
No. It's, what was it? Like you were in a tuxedo. Like it was after we were on the, Jonathan Colton cruise ship. Is it okay that I'm talking that we were on the thing? Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any boundaries that I should know about? Like
we'll get, if we
find
them,
I'll
wave a hand or something.
Okay. And you're dressed like 007. Like you have the best tux on and you are in the like fancy suite.
Right.
And you get behind the bar. And you start talking, like, just describing to me scotch and how it's, like, the science of how, I don't even remember because I was slightly buzzed by that point, but I was in amazement that you knew so much about alcohol.
I became, as I have been saying, the single most annoying person to have a drink with on the planet.
Not for, oh, do you think so? Because
I worry, believe me. The word actually comes out of my mouth. I'm sitting with somebody having a drink or in a bar, and I hear the word actually, and I think, I see where I'm about to go with this. There's a very strong chance I'm going to lose the person who I'm with. But if you get, well, you actually probably know this better than most people, that when you can take something that people feel like they have at least a passing familiarity with, if not an intimate familiarity with it, right? And do a deep dive, right? That can sometimes be off-putting, but sometimes it's world-changing. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was for me. I mean, beginning... you were talking about wanting to write your sex book since you were 9. Like when I went back and looked at my files, when I started writing the book and realized that I had, you know, 15 years of string that I've been collecting on this stuff, on the science of how it's made, science of taste and smell, the science of the effects of ethanol on the body and brain, that I was like, oh, I've actually been writing this book for a long time.
Cool.
So when you, you know, you develop that interest, it's something that people think they already know about, which is a lot of what you do too, right? I mean, people feel like they have a,
Let me
start you over.
Yeah. Oh, but sex. Oh, I could teach that like in 10 minutes. Like no big deal. I'm all like, you know,
so you get an actually too. You push the glasses up on your nose and you,
but what I've learned to do is not do an actually. I try not to like exclusionary language or corrective language. And I like to do expansive language.
Sure.
Like
absolutely.
I do a lot of
and
exactly.
Yes. Anding. Yes.
Exactly. Sure. Exactly. It's exciting. And so, I cornered you recently and I went, Adam, wait a minute. You just wrote a book on alcohol. What do you know about alcohol and sex?
And I said, nothing. But then I started to think about it.
Yeah. And you have science. You know things.
I hope so.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Like, okay. So what did you mention? You mentioned something that caught my interest about the effects of alcohol on people in bars and what that means in the mating game.
Yes.
Tell me the things.
Well, the interesting thing about the effect of ethanol on the brain, on behavior, right, is that a lot of people will tell you, they'll tell you stories about how it affects them, right? And they'll tell you stories about how they get very aggressive when they're drinking, or they get promiscuous, or they'll say, actually, tequila makes them more angry and gin makes them something or whatever, right? And we tell these stories about ourselves and about the that as if ethanol has some kind of intrinsic pharmacological effect.
You're saying ethanol is that the that's the base content in all alcohol. That's the thing that makes us feel drunk.
Right. I mean, and just to do the organic chemistry that terrified me out of actually being a research scientist, but alcohols are actually a large class of molecule.
Okay.
Right. So, the one that you have, like rubbing alcohol mm-hmm. is different from the methanol that mm-hmm. can poison you if you get bad booze is different than the ethanol, which is the active ingredient in a drink.
Okay.
So in beer, wine, tequila, whatever the stuff that we drink, it's the ethanol is the main and probably the only psychoactive ingredient.
Is it like types of mushrooms?
Well, so, you know, it's interesting you should bring up other kinds of recreational drugs, right? So it's not a difference in species, right? Like if you're talking about the difference between, let's say, a shiitake mushroom and a maitake and a mm-hmm. whatever, lion's ear or
the
whatever
funny
they call
ones.
Them, right? Yeah. So those are actually going to be different species of fungi, right?
Okay.
Yeast, the thing that does fermentation, right? That changes sugar into ethanol and carbon mm-hmm. dioxide is a fungus, like mm-hmm. a mushroom. But what I'm talking about are actual molecules, right? Actual chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll have slightly different structures,
mm-hmm.
slightly different numbers of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens mm-hmm. in different order, different arrangement, right? Mm-hmm. And in this case, there's a particular one that we have in drinks that changes the way we feel, changes the way we think, changes what happens in our body, which is really neat, right?
And that's ethanol.
And that's ethanol. Super interesting, especially in comparison to other recreational drugs. Mm-hmm. Human beings take a lot of chemicals that change our mindset, change the way we feel, right?
Oh, like caffeine and caffeine.
And sure, like caffeine. And you know, regardless of how you feel personally about the sort of legality and morality of things like psilocybin in a mushroom mm-hmm. or marijuana or methamphetamine mm-hmm. or cocaine or heroin, researchers who study those things can articulate mechanisms mm-hmm. for how they work.
So exciting.
In the brain. Mm-hmm. They can't for ethanol.
What?
It's not well understood. There are some ideas, some really good ones, but ethanol is still really mysterious. That's
okay.
Cool, right? So when you sit down in a bar, when you take a drink and it does something to you, what does it do? Well, it turns out that what it does is profoundly affected by what social scientists call expectancies.
Mm.
Which is to say, what you kind of are trained socially to think is going to happen.
Okay.
Is what happens.
Is this like when people believe in astrology and they're like, oh, you're a Scorpio. You're going to have lots of sex, Scorpio. It's in your pants, you know, and it's like, you're dumb. But
but if you believe that about yourself.
Exactly. It's self-fulfilling.
Yeah.
So that's expectancy.
Yeah. So, which is super weird. Right. and not what I thought I was going to learn when I started reporting. I was like, oh, well, ethanol should do a certain thing in the brain. It should. Well, no. Right.
Okay.
So how do you study that? Well, that turns out to be really difficult. And this is true if you're studying sex behaviors, but any kind of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because if you're studying the effects of a chemical,
okay.
what you want to do is you want to have a study set up with something called a placebo, mm-hmm. right? So I give you a blue pill that has the chemical that I'm studying in it, and I give this other group of people over there the same kind of blue pill under the same conditions that doesn't have the chemical in it, right? And you see what happens.
Uh-huh.
It's really hard to do that with ethanol.
Mm-hmm.
If I give somebody a drink that has ethanol in it, they can tell.
Is there a placebo taste to alcohol taste?
Well, so in the...
Am I jumping ahead?
No. Well, so it took decades of research, almost a century of research,
uh-huh.
before a guy named Alan Marlatt finally figured out that he could make, essentially, a very weak vodka tonic.
Okay.
it was like one... I think it's one part vodka, five parts tonic. Uh-huh. That he could do that, and people could not tell better than chance whether they were getting a drink with alcohol or not.
Okay.
Now, what that let him do is set up not just the standard placebo design of a double blind, like control group that's getting nothing, and then the group that's getting the chemical, right? Mm-hmm. He could actually set up four groups. And those four groups would be, you think you're getting tonic water, and you get tonic water.
Okay.
You think you're getting a vodka tonic, and you get a vodka tonic.
Mm-hmm.
But he could also have two other groups. You think you're getting tonic water, and you get a vodka tonic.
What?
And you think you're getting a vodka tonic, and you get a tonic.
Okay.
So now four groups, right? And the interesting ones there are expects placebo gets ethanol, or expects ethanol gets placebo.
Yeah.
And he started to find, and the researchers who came after him and did the same model, started to find all kinds of crazy stuff.
Like what?
If you think you're getting ethanol,
uh-huh.
you behave as though you're getting drunk.
Okay.
Even though there's no ethanol in your system.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't think you're getting ethanol,
mm-hmm.
you aren't. You don't. You stay sober. to a certain point. I mean, at a certain point, you start to feel the effect, like you start to wobble, right? You start to get all of the kind of the effects in the brain that sort of happen at a more core level that aren't just behavioral, but right, are like you slur words and you,
exactly.
And you slur words not because you think you're going to, but because the muscles in your throat and tongue are actually getting...
It's physiological.
Yeah. But in the range that I'm actually interested in the book, and in the... if you're talking about binge drinking or dependencies, addictions, mm-hmm. that's a separate issue for me. I was mm-hmm. really interested in casual, what's called casual drinking, mm-hmm. right? Or sort of like two sips into your second round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like that's the range that I was sort of interested in. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that's really hard to study. So that's where these expectancies come in. And in fact, not only if you're trying to build a really good study, not only do you have to come up with these placebo drinks and these mm-hmm. different groups, but then you build entire labs that look just like bars.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. So you build basically a holodeck for drinking, right? So in your lab, you build, you know, a bar that seats 10 people and that there's music playing and you turn the lighting down and there's bottles behind the bar and there's a bartender working there and you simulate the experience mm-hmm. because the theater of it mm-hmm. sets your expectancies on fire, right? It gets your expectancies going.
Yeah.
And theater, I think maybe sometimes when I talk about the theater of it, that sounds denigrating, and I totally don't mean it that way. The theater is really important, the experience of it. And in fact, in the cultures that consume ethanol, and mm-hmm. a lot of them do, the rituals will be very different, mm-hmm. and the outcomes of the rituals are different. You know, there's a wonderful book called Drunken Comportment. It's mm-hmm. just a terrific title. That's an ethnological study of all the different, around the world,
really?
Different cultures and what they do when they're drinking. And, huh. and the point of the book is that it walks up, sort of walks right up to the line of saying, though it never really crosses it, that ethanol has no intrinsic effect. Mm-hmm. And it all depends on those expectancies and on the social learning.
Mm-hmm. It seems like the permission drug. It kind of...
Well,
right. Oh, you made a face just then. Oh, I'm excited.
So that's the... So what do we, you know, what we think we know, right? Okay. And this is especially, especially relevant to sex behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. Is it's a disinhibitor. Mm-hmm. Right. It takes the lid off. You go.
But it's not like physiologically doing it. Like it's not blocking something in the brain, but you're saying it's the inhibitions that are socially put there. Like we're allowed to step beyond that. Like getting out of the box. Is that what you mean?
That's what the story that you'll hear about it is. And I would say too, like it, as we start to talk about the behaviors, it probably makes sense to not try to get too wrapped up in what's actually happening kind of neurophysiologically, mm-hmm. like what's happening with the synapses in the brain, just because that's not that well understood. And you could sort of talk about what areas of the brain are doing what and how that changes mm-hmm. under the influence of ethanol, but even that's not really that well understood. And once you're in the world of talking about behavior, it probably makes sense to stick with just the sort of what the social, for me at least, mm-hmm. what I understand is stick with what the social scientists understand, mm-hmm. because even they haven't managed to really bridge the gap between what they know about ethanol mm-hmm. and behavior and what the geneticists understand about it and what the neurobiologists understand about it.
This is behavioral. This is what we're observing in the nature.
That's right. People in the wild.
Yeah. Fascinating. I get very National Geographic. Do you ever get like a British documentary, like voiceover in your head when you're in a bar?
I had the show Connections, which I don't know if you remember as a British science documentary from the 80s mm-hmm. in my head almost the whole time as I was working on the book, because I wanted to be able to go from beat to beat of, like, you know, to go from ancient Alexandria to the Middle Ages in Europe to, you know, a distillery in Kentucky today. Like, you got to be able to jump the way the BBC used to know how to jump.
You got Morgan Freeman in your head or somebody, you know?
David Attenborough. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So.
Okay.
So what they will, what the hypothesis, right? What the intuition that people have going into doing this kind of research is alcohol is disinhibiting. Mm-hmm. So it makes people do things that they ordinarily have under control, but then they sort of lose control. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, they engage in all sorts of unsafe behaviors. Mm-hmm. And you can define unsafe in a lot of ways.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it becomes especially potent as a definition if you're talking about not using a condom and being more exposed to mm-hmm. STIs, HIV, right?
Consent issues, domestic violence, like there's
right,
so many things.
Sure. And even you
table
know,
dancing. Oh God, let's not even go there.
Yeah, well, and then you start to build into some of the older research that I was just looking at today because I knew we were going to talk of just having sex. Like, does it make you more likely to have sex? Mm-hmm. Because notionally. And this is sort of a imagery dating back to Victorian England, at least women who were drinking were more were perceived to be, you know, sluttish, basically, mm-hmm. right?
Okay.
So there's a lot of, it's heavily gendered as well.
Right.
The bar typically, which is in the West where our ritual happens for consuming mm-hmm. alcohol, right? Until really relatively, very recently, was Masculous. A place where only yeah. men went. And if there were women there, they were sex workers, basically.
So true. I'm in the middle of watching Deadwood right now.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, this is not related at all, but it's just interesting. one of the reasons that we have things like bitters and soda pop uh-huh. Is that while the bar was a place, was a male space, was a masculine space, uh-huh. right? The drugstore, which also sold ice creams mm-hmm. and non-alcoholic drinks, mm-hmm. was not. That was a space that women could go as well.
Okay.
So it became a place where you could have sort of socially acceptable courtship, but the people behind the bar there,
okay.
right, were making their own sort of drinks. There's a guy named Darcy O'Neill who's done a lot of great history and research on this. So they were coming up with stuff like, well, how do we can make tinctures and bitters, which is flavors in ethanol, right?
Okay.
I'll come up with this formula with this syrupy, sugary stuff that if I mix it with soda water, people will like it. And because I'm a pharmacist, I have access to all kinds of other recreational chemicals like uh-huh. opiates and like
there were opiates coca in drugs. The pop shops?
So like, for example, maybe we could put a little extract of coca leaf in this syrup and I'll flavor it and here will be Coca-Cola, says the pharmacist. Right.
Are we talking 1940s, 1920s?
Yeah. Like 18s.
18s. Okay, 20s. So okay, way before
beginning
that.
Beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
And that's when pop laced with cocaine.
All kinds of fun stuff.
Yeah. All sorts of, I don't even know.
In a space where men and women were both allowed to be. Which
interesting.
Which the bar was not like that.
Stuff that we now consider much harder than alcohol.
Yeah, that's right.
See what happens when we repress ourselves, you guys? You see what happens?
But, okay, so when you actually start to study what happens when people are drinking, you know, sort of from that casual amount up through kind of the binge drinking level, and you say, well, is it true that they're not likely to use condoms if they have sex?
Mm-hmm.
And so I read a really interesting paper that said it was a study was doing interviews of young people from the mid-90s, so people from 12 years old to 30 years old, and asking them about their sexual experiences. And what the researcher found was that if their first sexual experience was before 1985,
mm-hmm.
they were more likely to have that experience involve alcohol and to not use a condom.
Hmm.
If it was after 1985, it was the opposite. And her thesis, her hypothesis there, was that it was because of AIDS education.
Mm-hmm.
That what had happened was that had worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they finally got people to understand, like, really, you can't go out there and not use a condom. Like, it's just mm-hmm. not, don't do that. And people learned the lesson. So mm-hmm. the behavior flipped.
So then people started using condoms and no alcohol.
Yeah. Less so. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's still ethanol involved in a lot of cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, trying to figure out, like, well, okay, are women who drink more likely to have sex?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer that you would expect to that is, well, yeah. That's the story.
Obviously,
duh,
right. That's what we know to be true as people in society. It is clear from everything I've witnessed.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And it turns out not to be the case.
What?
Unless they kind of go in thinking like, oh, I get promiscuous when I've been mm-hmm. drinking. Right. If that's mm-hmm. the expectancy, then that gets fulfilled. Which doesn't necessarily mean there's a negative outcome. Right. It just means they're having sex, but doesn't necessarily mean that they're having unsafe sex. That's the thing they aren't finding. Right. Is that there may be an increased likelihood of sex, but it's not increasing the likelihood of not using a condom. And then what I didn't find, and so this may be out there, but I didn't see the research,
okay.
was whether people were, after being under some influence of ethanol, in more dangerous situations, more likely to be in non-consensual situations, more likely mm-hmm. to have violence. Because one thing that ethanol does do is, as a across the board, across demographic effect, is it tends to increase aggression levels, have violence associated with it.
Aggression levels. Yeah. Violence. Interesting. It's interesting.
It's weird.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I'll go through a cocktail phase. Like, I mean, I've seen you, and you're so good at like being able to examine a cocktail menu and see what's a, like an excellent cocktail. And then you'll talk about it. But it's interesting. And whether you like it or not, the people around you find it interesting. No good. one is shaming you.
I'm really glad.
Or judging.
It's good. Yeah. I would do it either way, but it is, it is a fun way to engage on it. Like it's a certain kind of connoisseurship that I understand. So.
I have witnessed just everyone being like, yeah, tell us more about the science. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What's interesting is that like, I went through a gin and tonic phase, and people would say all sorts of things when I went through my gin and tonic phase. Which is like, ooh, that's the angry one.
Oh, right.
Ooh, yeah. You get a little emotional and you just break up with somebody. What's going on there? I'm like, dude, no, it's... And because
it's
I don't
just
have,
hot out.
Yeah, it's delicious.
And it's yummy.
It's fucking delicious. And I don't have... I never believed or had any... I didn't ever expect it to be more like Sarah Jessica Parker when I drank Cosmos, you know?
Well, it's weird because, you know, if you were trying to tell yourself that different categories of booze make you feel different ways, then I say, like, my head goes, okay, what would the mechanism for that be? How would that work?
Mm-hmm.
And so what you want to answer, say, well, obviously it's not just ethanol. Obviously there's something else.
Mm-hmm.
In these things, there's something different in bourbon than there is in gin that would make you feel differently, right? So what would that be? What's the other psychoactive chemical? And nobody's ever found any evidence that there is one. There's some people who talk about histamines, which may have some psychoactive effect, but there's not good research. The classic story about this is absinthe, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, break it. What is it? Does it make you high?
Well, so absinthe is a... it's an anisette. It's a licorice flavored or fennel flavored, very strong.
Super gross.
Liqueur, right?
Totally gross.
Well, all right.
To me.
We could have an argument about that, but.
Yeah, I'm being very liquor negative right now. It's just me.
You're absinthe shaming. well, so in the Byronic days, right?
Okay.
The Europeans were drinking just a huge amount of this stuff. And there was violence around it, and people started to panic, and they thought that they thought there was something called absinthism, that basically you drank enough of this stuff and you turn into essentially an epileptic murderer, like you'd have seizures and you'd kill people. And what they thought was going on was that one of the ingredients in absinthe is wormwood, it's a botanical plant. And in wormwood, there is a molecule called thujone. Thujone is a hallucinogen.
Thujone, okay.
It's great spelling. It's thujone, which is a weird, it's a word that looks very strange on the page, but right. And take enough of thujone and you smell colors, whatever, right?
Oh.
It's a hallucinogen like any of the other ones, right? So people thought, oh my God, too much thujone in the absinthe. We're banning absinthe. No more absinthe. Uh-huh. And that gave rise to a whole bunch of other drinks that were sort of replacements for absinthe that didn't have it. So like Pernod is another anisette that came out to replace thujone containing, wormwood containing absinthe. So about, it must be about 15 years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, a cocktail obsessive, an absinthe obsessive guy named Ted Breaux went back, B-R-E-A-U-X, not the dude, not that kind of bro. went back and analyzed a lot of pre-ban absinthes to try to figure out what was in them.
Yeah.
And what he found was that the levels of thujone were vanishingly small. Like they were subclinical. Like there was no way that would make anybody go crazy. They were super high proof. There was so much booze in this stuff, so much ethanol, that people were just getting blitzed.
So there wasn't a hallucinogen in old... That's an urban myth?
Yeah, it wasn't hallucinogenic, just really, really strong. Now, stuff that's really, really strong can have an effect. You think about Night Train, right? You think about the things that sort of the super cheap kind of booze that's essentially there for people who are substance addicted.
Wait,
right?
You just said nitrate?
Night Train, which is
Night Train?
Yeah.
What is Night Train?
Basically, as strong ethanol as you can possibly sell.
Oh, okay. Oh, is that a brand?
Yeah, it's the name
of the
thing.
I thought
Sorry.
It was a different... Yeah. Chemical or something.
Right. No, right.
Sounded official. Very sciencey.
I start to get that tone, and now pretty much anything I say.
I will believe anything you say now.
That's right. It's weaving the spell of science.
Scholarly.
That's right.
I think it's important to understand. I mean, it's like, I'm not going to tell someone like, dude, that whole gin thing, like not a thing, not a real thing. No, man. No, every time. Like, I'm sorry, I get so emotional when I'm vodka-ing. Like, I don't do vodka anymore, not after 98. Woo-hoo, you know,
that particularly ugly evening.
Yeah.
Well, this is when I get particularly actually E, where I, you know, where I started to be like, all right, well, let's talk about that. What would be doing that? Mm-hmm. What could possibly be doing that? Because if you're telling me that like gin does something to you that bourbon doesn't, mm-hmm. how is that possible when they are really, if you look at the way that they're made, kind of the same thing.
Gin and bourbon?
Well, so, right. The brown liquors, you know, bourbon whiskeys, right, are basically distilled beer, mm-hmm. right? So you take a grain and you kind of cook that and ferment it and then run it through the still.
Okay.
Right? And if you, you do that sort of a certain number of times, essentially, or at certain temperatures or for a certain amount of time, whatever, there's plenty of dials to turn in this process. You get a clear distillate comes out of the other end of the still, mm-hmm. and then you put that in barrels for a while and it comes out brown and yummy and whatever, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Well, if you do that enough times more, a clear distillate comes out of the still and you have vodka. You've distilled everything out of it except the ethanol and the water.
Okay.
Do that enough times and do it with some flavoring plants like citrus rinds or juniper.
And you get gin.
Right. So you can start from the same place from a grain. You know, you can take a fermented grain and get a grain spirit and make gin out of that, right? And flavor, like take all of the kind of grain flavor out or much of the grain flavor out, put in plant flavors and you get gin. Don't do that and you get whiskey, right? It's a decision tree, mm-hmm. you know? And look, it's not always the case. You can start from a bunch of different substrates. You could start from grapes and you could get a brandy. You could start from sugarcane juice and get rum agricole or molasses and get rum, or you can, you know, right. You can go all these different directions depending on the ingredients and the process and all that other stuff. But fundamentally, if somebody says to you that gin is going to make you morose, mm-hmm. but that vodka is going to make you peppy, the answer has to be how,
right.
How can that be? What thing is doing that?
How is that possible?
And cause the answer, right. Really, I think most scientists think is, expectancies.
Okay.
Because you go in thinking, this is how I'm going to feel tonight.
It's like alcohol string theory, you know?
You, except the difference is you can actually test this.
And okay,
you,
right,
string theory
right.
has other testy problems. Yeah.
Are there any other like little tidbits that you've nerded out on that you'd like to share?
Well, so.
Oh, no. He did a hand in the air. Like, wow, you guys. Like, there's a flourish.
Goes. That's right. It is on now. So there is another story, right, that you will hear is like, well, alcohol makes you horny, right? Like you drink enough and you start to sort of get turned on. So you can do studies, maybe not you and I, but studies have been done. Researchers have done studies, right, where you take your four groups mm-hmm. that I was talking about before, right? The placebo, the not placebo, the think you're getting a placebo, but not the think you're not getting a placebo, but are those four, right? You can take those guys, mm-hmm. start with men.
Okay.
Attach them to a device that checks how strong an erection they have.
Oh, like a measuring arousal right. in their body.
Check tumescence, show mm-hmm. them pornography, mm-hmm. see what happens. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can then build on that. You can give them instructions designed to induce expectancies. So you can say, uh-huh. okay.
I've been very excited.
Here's some booze.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to show you some porn. Uh-huh. You're not going to be as turned on as you ordinarily would. So
okay.
just expect that. Uh-huh. Right. And then the guys in the other room, you say, okay, here's some booze. We're going to show you some porn. You're probably going to get more turned on than you would ordinarily.
Yeah.
Right? And you just tell them that.
Right.
And then you like go in the other room and you stand there with your clipboard and you watch the gauges, you know? So the only association that they find is that basically the more booze you give men, mm-hmm. the less of an erection they get.
Okay.
So up to a certain point, there's no difference, no matter what expectancy you set, and then you give them enough booze and they go off a cliff.
In terms of losing like impotence, basically.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's sort of you're measuring a curve of tumescence, right? You're measuring sort of like not just are they hard, but how hard are they?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, and then what are they reporting that they're feeling as well?
The spectrum of semi.
Yeah. Okay. Right, sure. You know? Good. It's a curve.
Oh God, that's a t-shirt. Okay. Anyway,
I'm going to pretend that I was setting that up all along. Now, and so then you go like, all right, well, but ladies.
Yeah. Right?
So you do the same test, uh-huh. same groups, mm-hmm. the vaginal photoplethysmograph.
Ooh, right?
Where you're testing vaginal blood flow, mm-hmm. basically, right? With mm-hmm. passing light. Yeah. You knew that already. Mm-hmm. And
no, I lose the details after a while. There's just so much. But then I have people like you who do it, like, oh.
See, because for me, I take a very special, a special particular kind of delight in the fact, in the, just the word photoplethysmograph.
Until I meet the machine and put it inside me and have somebody measure stuff.
Yeah.
I just don't, it's like I need.
You have to go meet the machine.
Yeah, I have to go meet the machine. It's like until I make gin myself. I have a hard time remembering how booze is made. Like I just need to go do the thing. It's sex science. It's kind of hands on, you know.
That's true. There's a little bit of interesting research in that where you sort of attach the people to the things that measure the parts and then like sort of shove them in an fMRI tube, you know, like see what happens, which is great. It's very difficult research in many respects. A lot like trying to study the effects of ethanol, right? Very difficult to study. Like, how do you set up a study? It's really complicated. Like, how do we do this? Like, we don't really know how to study.
So many variables.
Exactly.
And where were we?
Oh, right. So the women, same thing.
Wait, so let me just make sure I understand it. So hook these people up to measure physical arousal.
Right.
Show them porn. Their different expectancies. They were told nothing. They were told more horny, less horny. Like, so you said that... Eventually, everybody just goes off a cliff, and no one gets physically aroused.
Well, so there is. Well, they do. You do see arousal, right? And at a certain, and like we were talking about before, at a certain point, you have enough ethanol on board where you're having physiological effects. But on the way there, right on the sort of upslope, right, what you think is going to happen, what they tell you is going to happen, has much more of an effect than whether you have ethanol or not. Yeah.
Okay, so.
Different set of studies, but
the power of what is it called when
suggestion?
Yes, the power of suggestion does more than the level of alcohol in terms of arousal levels. Interesting. Oh,
weird, right?
Weird. Amazing. Wow. Power of suggestion. Okay. I'm curious. People who were sober. Okay, if we just got rid of suggestion, just looked at sober versus alcohol in the system, watching porn. Who gets more physiologically aroused before it just cliff dives? Like one drink, two drink in.
Oh, drinks in. I'd have to go back and look what the control looked like. I don't remember.
Okay, I'm curious. What I imagine is that the people who are sober get more physiologically.
Yeah, that's what I'm remembering. It was there too. I'll look and I'll double check.
I just, you know, like all the drunk people being like, "Oh, this has never happened to me before." Yes, what? Well, so, like there's no expectation, but they're like, "Why is my stuff not working or lubricating or right?"
Yeah, and it's and that is what you know people will say. They'll report saying, "Oh no, alcohol has an aphrodisiac effect generally and on me," but then when they do self-report. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, what happened when you were drinking? It's like, well, didn't work. You know, your performance suffers, right? Mm-hmm. You're less likely to get aroused. As a matter of physiology.
Oh, so interesting. What else? Got anything else? Double back.
I think there was something else I was going to tell you about. Oh, can I tell you about the fruit flies? Which is a totally different thing, but it's cool.
Making a face right now.
Yeah.
Okay. I trust you.
You don't actually care about fruit flies, I know, but this is just a great. So, as I said, very difficult to study ethanol, right? So,
why is it difficult again?
Well, because it's hard. Well, first of all, it's hard to study people.
I mean, versus mushrooms or versus like marijuana.
Oh, so, no. Studying the effects of those things is difficult as well.
Oh, like that's just true. Studying the effects of these things on the human brain, period, is difficult.
Yeah. Okay. And made even more so with ethanol because it's very, just because of some variables in how you administer it.
Okay.
It's hard to trick people into not knowing whether they're getting it or not.
All right. Okay. Okay.
You know, you can have a pill with THC and without THC.
Okay.
Right. Or you can have the same kind of pill that has an opiate in it or that doesn't.
Wait.
Right?
Alcohol enemas. There you go. Fixed it. Figured it out.
I'll tell you a funny story.
Oh no.
So around the turn of the 20th century, when more and more people were kind of moving from labor to like office work. Mm-hmm. A lab in Boston, a nutrition lab, got really interested in trying to figure out what actually are the effects on the human body and brain of ethanol, because everybody's drunk all the time and we don't know if that's a problem or not, basically, right? Like, you know, if these people are showing up to work drunk, is that okay?
Okay.
We don't really know. So among a bunch, and now this is a time when they don't have, they don't know what genes are yet. They don't know how to study heredity or genetics. They don't have imaging like we have. They barely have X-rays. They don't have magnetic resonance. They have none of that stuff. They barely have the machines they have to study kind of reflexes and how people respond and how they time their behaviors are super primitive. They're like boardwalk games, basically. Okay. Like you got to catch something that's moving, or they actually used typewriters, like type this word over and over again. Let's see how fast you can do it.
Okay.
Have you ever tried to type drunk? That's, you sort of know what that feels like. Mm-hmm. So one of the tests that they did was they wanted to understand the metabolism of alcohol, how long it took to get into the system, out of the system, and what effects that had. So they took this guy. They never said what his name was. He used an alias, Ius, I-U-S. He was a kid, Harvard med student.
Okay.
But a little kind of slight little guy who for a week volunteered to, here's what he'd do. He would come into the lab in the evening after dinner. Mm-hmm. They would, and he would sort of get cleaned up, get ready for bed. And they would, shove him into kind of this metabolic coffin so they could measure gas going in and out, like his breathing. Huh. They had these makeshift electrodes that they would fasten to his wrists and his ankles so they could study his heart rate, which were basically gauze soaked in salt water because they didn't have real electrodes yet.
Wow.
They would put him into this kind of tube, this closed system, and play a noise at him that he could respond to with a button in his hand until he fell asleep. Mm-hmm. And when he fell asleep, so just imagine this for a second. Like you're sleeping in a coffin with this thing like, hey, you asleep yet? You asleep yet? You asleep yet? What about now?
Terrible. That's the worst thing ever.
Awful, right? So he finally falls asleep. He also has a tube up his butt.
Oh my God.
Where depending on what night and what they're doing, they're either going to drip salt water or ethanol.
They're giving him an enema while he's trying to fall asleep?
Well, he's already asleep before the enema starts, which is kind of even worse in a way.
Oh my God, this is so kinky. I can't even handle it.
Right? Alcohol research, full of butt stuff. Oh. And then, so he wakes up the next morning, right? They let him out of the coffin. They take the tubes out, let him go pee.
Give him some coffee.
And then, no coffee yet.
Oh.
Can't do that. That would mess it up.
Okay.
And then they come and they administer a bunch of tests because they want to know, okay, so 6 hours ago while you were asleep, we gave you either booze or not booze. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why don't they still... Okay, anyway.
Why don't they still do that? Hard to find volunteers, I think, is the answer to that.
What? I mean, that just seems like we've figured it out. More butt stuff. I mean, it's...
solved the problem?
Yeah. We learn about everything.
And they did not... What they learned was, yes, the ethanol impaired him later in the day, which is like, no, really. That's what you came up with. He was somewhat impaired. Not greatly impaired, but somewhat impaired. The next day, he worked more slowly.
Good to know. Sure. I mean, if you're drinking the night before and you smell like alcohol on the job, is that a problem? No.
Because they genuinely didn't know. They genuinely weren't sure. And in fact, and people were sort of regularly drunk all the time anyway. Mm-hmm. Like the run up to prohibition in this country really was full of just like, everyone's always drunk.
I mean, I did not know that. This is just a quick factual check. Because I have never really thought about this. But if I were to imbibe at midnight, go to bed, sleep for 8 hours, wake up at 8, and then get to work by 10, am I... Because I thought that like per hour, like, oh, you have one drink, it takes an hour for it to go away. Like that's, you know, like the little chart. So
it varies from person to person, but that's the way that we're supposed to think about it. Women tolerate and process ethanol about half as well as men do, even accounting for body mass. Nobody's really sure why.
Like two drinks, go to bed, 10 hours later,
You're
not drunk, even though you smell like it.
Yeah, no, that is true. You are not. Your body has dealt with the ethanol. It's out of your brain by and large. Now, the weird thing about that is that with a hangover, for example, if you get above 0.1 blood alcohol, so, mm-hmm. you know, driving drunk is 0.08, mm-hmm. right? You get above 0.1, you're almost certainly going to be hungover to some, at mm-hmm. some level. And a lot of the studies, they take people up to like 0.2 is like heroically drunk. That's just like,
heroically drunk.
That's
a memoir.
It was it's a good title. Bad decision. Good title. But they, your hangover symptoms are at their worst when your blood alcohol is at zero.
Really?
Yeah, it's all gone.
So that whole thing about wake up and take a little bit of alcohol to help get rid of your... Are you telling people they should drink in the morning to help with their hangover?
Well,
what are you saying?
There's a good story about why the hair of the dog works, but nobody knows whether it's true or not. So the hair of the dog makes you feel better, right? You have a drink, you're hungover, you wake up, you have a drink, half a drink, and you do the hangover symptoms
is
get less.
Is that what hair of the dog means?
That's what the hair of the dog
means.
Okay. It's the full phrase is the hair of the dog that bit you. The dog having bitten you being the booze, right?
You take a hair to make you feel better. Oh, yeah, okay, exactly. Interesting. Very witchcrafty.
Yeah, that's right. So you could say nobody really, this is a hypothesis.
Okay.
That the hangover is actually the result of mild methanol toxicity. So we were talking about different kinds of alcohols.
Oh. Right?
So methanol is present in any kind of
it's the stuff that can poison you.
Right.
Oh, and that's why better liquors might be better in terms of hangovers?
Well, whoa,
that's an urban
myth.
Is that an urban myth thing?
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to do that, because that's also not proven. That nobody's ever shown that. The idea that like more pure, better, higher quality, more expensive gives you less of a hangover, it's not true. You'll get a hangover from those too.
Okay.
But, so methanol is the thing that makes you go blind if you have cheap moonshine.
Oh, no.
Right? For really interesting reasons. The enzyme that breaks down ethanol in our bodies.
Focus on the sex.
All right. This isn't sexy at all then. I can't bring it back around. Anyway, the idea would be that like if you have a little bit more ethanol that the methanol gets displaced essentially, but it's probably a bad idea.
Oh, the theory for why you drink a little bit in the morning is that you're pushing out the methanol that's
slowly
destroying
you. Yeah, the ethanol displaces
you.
The methanol off the enzyme, but it's, anyway, it's a pretty story.
Yeah, but it seems like hypothesis that's not proven.
Yes, that is correct.
Huh.
It's a bummer. Hangovers are a bummer, man.
So really, if you already kind of want to do something, you have some alcohol, it kind of just helps you on your journey of wanting to do the thing.
Well, I think...
I covered casual sex with a researcher. And we talked about, you know, when people imbibe and how that affects going after casual sex and the outcomes and stuff. And like, so we've talked a little bit about this. But
the question there is whether ethanol is the thing that makes you more likely to engage in casual sex where you wouldn't have otherwise, or whether you were thinking you were going to engage in casual sex and the ethanol gave you a sort of permission.
Right. Like is it an aphrodisiac?
That's what that would amount to.
Yeah.
Right. And the answer to that looks largely like no. It looks like if you're doing these studies in the lab, and maybe the researcher you talk to would say differently about that, but it's not something like, you know, I'm just going to go to the bar and I'm going to get a drink or two and then I'm going to go home, you know, maybe catch a Star Trek rerun and then that's it. But then you get there and you get sort of a drink and a half in, and you're like, on the other hand,
yeah,
check that out. Right. Yeah. Which, you know, seems to not be the case. But those expectancies are not just like how you feel that moment. They are built into you. They are what you saw in behavior when you were a kid. They are what your social circle does. They are they're not conscious decision making. They are they're what you've constructed about what ethanol does to you as a human being, as a fully formed human being.
All right, Adam Rogers, author extraordinaire of the book Proof: The Science of Booze, also a great gift for someone in your life. Or download it on Audible. I don't know. I don't know you. Enjoy. When you drink, do you think you have expectancies? I mean, what happens?
I'm starting to notice them more. I mean, I have definitely gotten more sensitized to what my outcomes are.
Okay. Are you overanalyzing it, you think? Like drunkenly overanalyzing yourself? So you're just noticing it more?
Well, I noticed that I do have some of the, like, I have a little of the aggression thing at some levels.
Like in that you become more alpha, like a little more like,
No, you don't understand.
Like you more, would you say assertive or do you mean like you want to punch something? Like,
no,
what are
I'm
we
not,
talking about?
I'm not violent, but I mean like, I'll argue. No, well, violence would be an issue. I would not be happy with myself if that were true. But no, I mean, definitely more like there's no reason to argue that point that vociferously.
Okay.
Like you got to let, that was
passionate.
A dumb thing to stake your, like really you're going to plant a flag in that? Like that's not what you're here for.
Okay.
You know, that's not so pleasant.
Right.
So I have a little of that. There's a little of the, and I think this is probably learned behavior from family, is a little of the maudlin thing.
Aww.
A little of the, like, it's the I love you, man joke, you know, sort of works on me. But I also get like starry eyed, like this city's the most amazing place I've ever been. Mm-hmm. Sort of, you know, that's the moment when my wife is saying, yeah, it's time for you to go to bed. You've had it.
We've definitely been talking for, I love that. You know, I was like, okay, I think we could fill a good 20 minutes. Like, no, there was like some solid, good stuff going on here. And this is great.
Good.
Because drinking happens a lot.
It does.
I don't know if you noticed.
I have noticed more and more.
Adam Rogers, where can people find you in the world?
Well, every so often I show up in Wired Magazine, where I'm an editor.
Mm-hmm.
And write now and then. I have a website, which is adam-rogers.net.
Okay.
And the book, Proof, is they're selling it places where they sell books, man.
Oh, so, yeah? In all the major bookstores?
Yep. The online places and the offline real world places.
Are there any particular preferable places you'd think people should go to get your book?
I'm trying to decide whether I'm supposed to have an opinion about that. I would like, in the same way that I'm trying very hard to learn that people should, if people drink, they should drink the thing that they like. If people buy books, they should buy books in the place where they like to buy books.
Okay.
It's a very personal and highly fraught decision these days. So.
That is a lovely thought. I like it. All right. Adam Rogers, thank you so much for making time for this.
It's my pleasure. I hope it was helpful.
Great. Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.